newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city...
The Media Project is a little bit of an opportunity for you to have a window into newsroom decision-making and in how journalism is functioning here in the beginning of the 21st century with some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, here with Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, and David Gustina of WAMC, who is the producer of this show. But you don't often hear David on this show.
No, but I am here. And the one thing I always want to make clear to our listeners is this will never be an hour.
The voice has spoken. It will not be.
I can only do so much work, Rex. You know what I mean? I got a lot on my plate. Let's just give them enough so that they want more next
week.
There
you go. Well, David is the guy who's responsible. And I think people often wonder, what is a producer? In this instance, the producer is responsible for coming up with the material that we discuss on the show.
And making sure people show up to the program.
Yeah, that's Judy Patrick. Issue. Oh, poor Judy will never. Last week, what happened, Judy?
That's fine, Judy. I was supposed to be here and I was not, and I got a call, and man, I felt very bad.
And you may not know that this mild-mannered Judy, I mean, we would expect this of Barbara.
Oh, my goodness.
Judy had an expletive there, right, when she realized, no offense, Barbara, but I don't.
No offense taken, because one of the many skills that I appreciate in David is his ability to clean me up and make me sound like I didn't say an expletive.
That too.
Well, the trick there is that, you know, we have a conversation, but there are stops, there are starts. Sometimes people have to clear their throat, Rex Smith, and we try to quicken the pace a bit, keep it moving. And
just
so we always record a little more than we need, and we edit to fit.
Well, let's get this show on the road.
Okay. So we ought to talk about the value of local reporting, because there's an interesting headline in a story from, I can't tell you where this came from.
Oh, it's my fault, Rex. I think it's Columbia Journalism.
Well, that would make sense. Gene Linden, anyway, who is a novelist and a journalist, who has written a story, the headline saying how a lack of local reporting affects the Supreme Court. You know, it sounds like a stretch, but the notion being that because there was inadequate local reporting on the case involving the website designer who didn't want to include LGBTQ language on a website that would violate her religious beliefs, that that became a Supreme Court case and so on. Turns out that this was based upon flawed factual data at the local level that the local court accepted. And then, of course, the Supreme Court doesn't rule on facts. Supreme Court rules on law. So it sounds like a bit of a stretch. But the point that I think is being made is that Americans' perceptions of things are based upon what they get in their local media often. And as local media diminish, there is less of that neighborly understanding of what's going on.
Right. I saw that headline and thought it was a stretch as well. But then I read the article and there have been several cases in which the underlying facts are distorted or wrong. And it's almost as if the case should have been dismissed somewhere along the line. But no local reporter ever wrote the story. And typically, that's what would have happened if a case is substantial enough to make it to the Supreme Court. You would have had even a small local paper would say, hey, look at us, we're going to the Supreme Court, or look at us, this case is going even to a state court, and they would have written about it. The court coverage is one of the things that have really declined over the last 10 years as we just don't have people to put in the courthouses. It's not just Supreme Court cases. It's every kind of story. Where do you think the New York Times, the Washington Post, LA Times, the Boston Globe get some of these big stories? They start with a local story, a local reporter finding something happening in their backyard, and they filter up.
It could really tick you off if you're a local editor when you see 60 Minutes picking up your story, you know, and kind of exaggerating it.
Well, how many times do we have to say that when you lose staff, numbers and numbers of human beings who are the reporters on the ground that are going to write these stories, we can't do justice. We can't often investigate and find the problems, the mistakes, the issues that would have maybe prevented this from ever making it to the court.
I definitely want to pat us on the back for all that we do and for bringing things to public light. But in the case of the LGBTQ cake issue, as an example that was in that article, where were the lawyers in that case? So that should have been done correctly with or without public knowledge. That should not be the burden of local newspapers to catch or not catch.
But isn't the bigger question the community perceptions that are changed by national conversations that then are sort of picked up by the local media? Think, for example, of the huge discussion about the immigration issue, about people coming into America at the southern border, and how that affects even local communities where there isn't a lot of immigration. We have a little bit of it in the capital region of New York, right? Perceptions change.
The perceptions change when you have, well, I'll just give you an example, guys. When I was in class this last Wednesday, I
was teaching at U Albany.
I was asked by students to play a piece by a former student and an intern who was here at WAMC, Christian Heinz, who did a story about the immigration in Albany and specifically on Central Avenue. And he looked at the different culinary, the restaurants, the folks who have come here from around the world to create a community for themselves. And in this, you learn about their entrepreneurial spirit, the fact that they want jobs and they want a chance to work, that they were, through this experience of setting up restaurants and interacting with people in the community, were becoming more entrenched. They were glad that there were these other cultures they could interact with. And the student reaction to hearing this very level-headed, in-depth piece where you're actually hearing migrants' voices telling their stories, some in a bit broken English, but clearly you could understand them. You began to see the students' eyes widen and their minds expand. And they began to say things in reaction like, wow, I want to go down to Central Avenue now and try one of these restaurants.
Right.
These seem like really hardworking people. Why do they keep saying migrants are taking things from us? You know, these kinds of arguments arose. So we can cover things in a reasonable way, in a way that illuminates what the truer situation is with the migrants in our communities than these overhead national arguments that seek to divide, not to unite.
Absolutely. You know, about 15 years ago at the Times Union, when Paul Grondahl was still a reporter for the Times Union, now running the New York State Writers Institute, we did a terrific series on Central Avenue.
Yeah.
Just about the 3-mile stretch from the state capitol out to the Colony Town line. And it was early in the days of videography online, so we had terrific videography by Steve Jacobs, who later went to work for the Glens Falls paper. And it was a story that looked at the history as well as the current life of Central Avenue, which has always been the avenue of immigrants in this community, which is why there was a German-speaking butcher shop when we moved here 30 years ago. And this has always been that kind of a melting pot, and it's wonderful to understand that and to help people grasp what's real as opposed to these perceptions that are dictated by Fox News, that if the local journalists don't sort of put it in context locally, all that people understand is what they're told to believe by these partisans of Fox News.
Those are great examples, David. And it reminds me, too, about on the abortion issue, wasn't it local reporting that made the public aware of the case of a 10-year-old girl who was
in
going
Indiana.
To be denied an
yes.
abortion? And it was being poo-pooed as phony news by Fox and others, but it was not phony, and it was local reporting from that area that made that a national story.
So it raises the question of how you are able to get across what's real. There are several fact-checking organizations. The Washington Post has a terrific fact-checking operation. There is a PolitiFact. And one of the questions that we are looking at as we're aiming toward the presidential race is the national perception of what things were like during the Trump administration versus what things are like during the Biden administration. And you need to have thoughtful, genuine reporting of facts of what's going on, as opposed to having stories told to you by politics, by politicians. And that's not easy when you have an erosion of local journalism and when you have journalists who focus on just the polling data instead of on what's actually findable by reporting.
Oh, don't get us started on polling, Rex.
I think we should.
It's how terrible. What percentage of those of us here believe wholeheartedly in polls?
Oh, dear.
I don't think any of us. I think we all recognize that polls are just a snapshot in time.
Or worse.
Well, and you have to obviously look at who is doing the poll. If you take the Siena College Times poll, I think you could say it's a pretty accurate poll. for the snapshot it's taking in time. But most people don't look further than the percentages. They don't look at the cross tabs, and they don't really read the whole thing. And they don't have a sense of the sample size, and they don't even know what that means. And then, like in an election year, and I've heard this from my students, why are we giving polls? Aren't we pushing people to think that, you know, oh, well, it looks like Trump and Biden have Super Tuesday wrapped up, so why would I even go out and vote? And then I think one of the other things that we all realize is that when it comes to elections, big elections, that the majority of people don't begin to pay attention until very close to that election date when perhaps those polls are the most accurate.
You know, if you've ever answered a poll, if someone calls you up and you start to participate in the poll, you realize how your responses could be misinterpreted. Like, I'm on a scale of 1 to 10, and you can't remember whether 10 is good or bad, and it can be very confusing. I like to also talk about our memory issues when it comes to Donald Trump, because people talk about, well, you know, January 6th, was, you know, this insurrection, wasn't this a terrible thing for Trump? Let's not forget that. Well, let's not also forget, before January 6th, there were 4 years of atrocious stories out of the Trump administration. He had all his relatives on staff. His handling of the COVID pandemic was horrible. Those seem to be entirely forgotten.
But how do you do that in journalism? There's a reason why all these key people who worked for him are saying, don't ever let him near authority anymore. His former chief of staff, General Kelly, for example, and the woman who was this communication director. How do you tell that story, though, without seeming to be biased?
You don't worry about seeming biased.
I'm with you, Barbara. That's the problem, isn't it? Never had a person that's run for president that has said the things that Donald Trump has said in a sort of promise to the endangerment of our own democracy. I'm going to be a dictator on day one. We'll read it right here from the article. The 91 felony counts, civil penalties for defamation and fraud, the litany of things that he did, January 6th, fake news, everything else that he's done has never been done before by a presidential candidate. And so if your democracy is in danger, in my opinion, all bets are off. We need to remind people why this person is dangerous over and over and over again.
And
but Judy's right. They have collective amnesia, and the American and human beings' ability to remember things when they have their own political party biases involved, it's very complicated. And I know that the press can inevitably outdo that collective amnesia. Barbara.
Yes, I think that it's the media's responsibility to repeat as needed, that we can't worry about this seems biased, because we're not being biased, we're being factual, and we are going to try to combat the amnesia, I would like to think. Here's the type of thing we're up against. You have Mitch McConnell, who after the January 6th insurrection gives this incredible speech about the mob that was incited by Trump, that, quote, one line where Maggie Haberman did a nice job reporting on the endorsement and bringing people a reminder about what he said. Former President Trump's actions preceding the riot were disgraceful, dereliction of duty. There was no question that Mr. Trump was practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day.
Is that a news story?
That was a news story, and that part, practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day, was part of what McConnell said.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. When he denounced Trump, but then went on to say, but I'm not going to vote to impeach him. That's something that should be in the criminal justice system, that's where it should be dealt with.
So the juxtaposition is a journalism decision. She just journalistically decided to juxtapose that alongside his decision to endorse Donald Trump now.
Right, right.
And that was an appropriate thing to do, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think being perceived or being viewed as biased is our Achilles heel, or the fear of it. I think
yes.
It drives a lot of what we do, and it's the one you can really wound us by accusing it, and it drives us to make poor decisions.
Yeah, we bend over backwards to appease the side that's criticizing us.
But how do you keep people paying attention if they don't trust your credibility? What do you do about this increasing polarization of Americans so that they only look at what they feel comfortable hearing, which is, of course, what has given Fox News power?
I wouldn't want to have to look back in hindsight and say it wasn't said enough.
Hmm.
Oh, we were afraid to. Why didn't we say this more?
Yes.
It wasn't said enough, because who else is going to say it?
Well, and, you know, this is part of what makes us human beings. In the article we're looking at, They cite James W. Pennebaker, a professor emeritus who researches collective memory at the University of Texas at Austin. He noted that polarization and a fractured media environment meant that Americans were less likely to agree on a set of facts, preventing the country from creating a collective shared memory. Now, let me give you an example I use all the time, and I've used it with you guys. Back in our day, when there were only three networks, TV stations, and there was PBS, when the president spoke, it was on every channel.
Sure.
You had to either watch it or go outside or do something else. That is a more shared, collective understanding of what the president said today than anything we have now. If anything, the media and online has created all these on-demand communities and lets everybody go into their little worlds, but not do we ever have this mass audience sharing in a collective experience unless you're watching the Super Bowl.
Which is, yes, which we can then root for whoever we want,
right,
without saying one is good and one is bad.
And swinging by to your earlier question, Rex, about polling, one of the many problems I have with polling is that they are asking people, how do you feel about this or that? And what do you think? And what's your opinion? As opposed to what's real? And then we're left to, the public and the media are left to figure out, well, what's driving those opinions? How were those opinions arrived at? And what's driving them, and what are we supposed to do about it? I just dread the thought of polls where people are saying to Mitch McConnell, do the endorsements mean anything to you? Is that important to you?
Of course not, people will say. Right. Oh, no, I don't.
Is January 6th a factor in your voting?
It's lazy reporting. I've always thought it was just an easy way to come up with a story. And the New York Times Siena poll about Biden's age, I thought, they decided to do that poll. And the question is the poll and putting that in prominent position on the front page of their paper and the top of their website, is that creating more of the discussion about Biden's age that wouldn't be there if they hadn't done the poll? I mean, what's the chicken and what's the egg in this scenario?
Right. They didn't decide to do a poll about, how do you feel about a presidential candidate who's stark raving mad?
Yeah, which, you know, maybe a little more reasonable question than that.
Okay,
Rex,
let me ask differently.
Exactly.
How do you feel about irrationality and about a presidential candidate who is hostile to the protection of the Western alliance or to a human rights, or who says he's going to be a dictator?
Yeah, do that poll. Let us come up with some questions.
Or who was called practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of January 6th by the top Republican in the Senate.
But here's the thing. Does he win because he's so negative? How about this? The environment created a kind of numbness that not even 91 felony counts or an enormous civil penalties for defamation and fraud can break through, says this article. This is Andrew Franks, a professor of political psychology at the University of Washington. Quote, negative information about Trump is no longer distinctive. It's just the air that we breathe, Dr. Franks said. It's the water that we're swimming in. It just becomes a conditioned emotional response where you either feel joy and admiration or disgust and anger at the sight of his face. But each individual act is just a drop in the ocean. That's exactly what has happened. People will say, even complaining about our radios, all it is complaining about Trump, negative on Trump all the time. So you get a nerd to it. That's just Trump.
Yeah.
Well, the New York Times, someone from the New York Times who was involved in the polling had written that the response rate from phone calls doing polls used to be 10%, and that the pollsters were worried that that wasn't really a great sample percentage.
Absolutely.
And now they say it's 1 to 2% of the people by phone are reached.
So most people don't answer a poll, and that means that those who do, a particular kind of person, perhaps. How do you know
that's right?
And of course, you know, every poll has to extrapolate based upon certain numbers. If you don't have enough people in your poll sample who are 65 and over, you'll extrapolate from those that you do have.
Yeah, and they weight polls. So, for example, so when they do polls in New York, they have to weight it heavily towards Democrats because Democrats are 2-1, more than 2-1 to Republicans in the state.
Right.
I just wish we would spend more newsprint and more airtime on talking about the issues, like what is Donald Trump's specific stand on immigration? What is Joe Biden's? What is their position on the federal debt? I mean, if you ask the average American, they have no idea. I have no idea, because it's not something that's discussed in the media. Instead, we're talking about the horse race.
Is part of the problem the mode of storytelling that we have? So, for example, when Trump says we're going to get rid of Obamacare and replace it with something much better, well, the fact of the matter is there has been no proposal that has come close to even being offered by the Republicans in Congress to present health care alternatives to Obamacare. But if you say that in a news story alongside Trump's declaration, we're going to replace Obamacare with something great, all that you're doing is saying, yeah, but they haven't done that. Don't you almost need to have some sort of a jazzy video presentation that grabs attention? Are we really outmoded in the way we're explaining things to people?
Yes.
I don't know
how the broadcast
get attention.
Yeah, well, and I'm outmoded too. I mean, from my students, they're not listening to the radio station.
Sure.
Appointment listening. They're going to do podcasts. They may tune in for go on the website and click on a story and listen to it, but it's a whole different approach. It's a whole different way of doing it, and it's on demand. So they're really organizing it around what they want.
You really need to present the news on TikTok and Snap. You know,
well, what if we just look at it this way? When you have it in a commercial marketplace, then you got to make money, or you got to have ratings, and then you got to present a criteria for what makes news, like the Golly Martha Rex, that gets people to tune in, right? So that seriously flaws everything. Right from the get-go, our criteria is making it a skewed perspective on what's happening today. And so we've given that to our audiences, and I think you're right. You said over the years that TV, largely an entertainment medium, and that's why people tune into TV programs for entertainment, it's turned into more about entertaining, about the sensational, about getting those eyes and those ears, rather than what Judy's talking about, a serious exploration of any issues in our world. And that's why I'm biased and think nonprofit journalism is more the way to go. It's not perfect. You have a board of directors, you have government money, you know, involved. But you may have more integrity, or at least a better approach at covering some of these stories than the usual.
I love not-for-profit journalism, but it isn't a be-all, end-all.
No.
WBUR, the Boston-based public radio station, is facing a huge problem because their sponsorship, which I guess you guys call underwriting.
Yes.
which we call advertising.
Well, yes, exactly.
Yes.
But it is down significantly. And so that is just the reality. And so while the Washington Post and the LA Times and all sorts of for-profit enterprises have been doing layoffs, we're beginning to see that happening. NPR has had job cuts. BUR.
WAMU.
Yep, in Washington. So it is a difficult situation because people are turning away from the news. And one of the reasons people are turning away from the news is that it is uncomfortable. It makes people who, by their nature, support Donald Trump angry when they hear this criticism. It makes people who support Joe Biden uncomfortable because there's always bad news.
How much of this has nothing to do with the media, but that we don't teach children to be citizens? Because if you were taught what a citizen is, it would be to pay attention to the important issues of the day, right? It would be to treat the world as a place where you can learn and understand better what's around you so that you can make a success of your life. And if we're not training people to understand the society around them and how to be a citizen, number one, vote, you know, and then, you know, all the important things about being a media critic, being skeptical, making sure you're reviewing multiple sources when you're looking for what the truth is.
That sounds almost like medicine. I think we need to teach them poetry and literature. You know, I'm sorry to sound like an old-fashioned liberal arts person, but, you know, people need to have empathy. And you learn empathy
by paying attention to the world. Yeah, I'm just tacking it from the school system aspect that we have a citizen class in school. I'm not talking about the media can't make you into a citizen. I think you have to start paying attention to media, start paying attention to the world around you, and care and have that empathy to be.
I think you're both right.
Yeah.
And there are ways to tell an issue story that makes it interesting. And our go-to form is usually an anecdote, which, you know, a heartwarming story about someone who's actually dealing with the issue. I mean, or in this digital age, there are probably ways to use graphics and video to tell some of these stories. Because all the issues we really care about have a human element. We just need to bring them to the surface.
Well, I think we sell ourselves short a little, too. I hear compelling pieces all the time, and they're not just on public broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are paying attention, you can find incredible journalism that's out there right now, whether it's in documentary form, whether it's in a network form, whether it's in a feature broadcast. it is out there. And there are really hardworking people putting together incredible stories for us to digest.
It's and on that positive note, have to end the program, Mr. Producer.
Okay. I thought you didn't want it to be an hour.
It's down to it's down to 15 minutes now. I talk too much.
That's David Gustine of WAMC. Barbara Lombardo has been here. Judy Patrick, I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American. We are the Media Project. We thank you for joining us and hope that you will join us again next week on the Media Project.
She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany, former Times Union associate editor Mike Spain, and me, David Gustina, producer of the Media Project, will also sit on the panel this week. Look for program number 1708. You can listen to the Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Thanks for listening.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.